I'm the preacher of the Perfect Church of Christ, but I want to announce to you all, I'm quitting right now, and beginning to start a cult. Have you seen what money you can get a cult leader compared to a faithful preacher? It's not even close. Now, of course, I want you to join. More people join so for me. And I don't expect you to join my cult for no reason. I'm going to prove to you that I have supernatural power and therefore to be worshipped as a leader. I have made a few predictions. Just yesterday, you can see, as proof that I wrote this all down yesterday, it says November 2nd, 2018, that's yesterday. Therefore, there's no way this could be fabricated. I've made a few predictions about today to prove I am who I say I am. Here's my first prediction. There shall be one among you who will wear blue. I'll still look at Kyle Lancaster here for a moment. Now, what color is your shirt? Yeah, it'd be blue. What about your pants?
Blue.
I made a prediction and it was correct. Second. Oh, what great misery here shall fall from the very sky. Now, I don't know about you, but at least where I came from, it was sprinkling when I left this morning. As soon as indeed I made a second great prediction. Prediction number three. A bracelet shall be upon my right wrist. Looky there. Yeah. And my final prediction. I shall die! Eventually, not today, hopefully, but eventually, I will die. And while this one has yet to come true, I will just wait and see. I bet you in a few years you can say, well, that DJ was right, he sure did die. I unfortunately being facetious, but there is a point I want to bring up about prophecy here, which shows a little bit the difference between the prophecy that we might see in the Bible and some of the supposed prophecy we'll see in the world. By the way, when I'm talking about prophecy, I want to be very specific about what I am talking about. A lot of people just have one ball of prophecy together and it's a predictive prophecy, which is what I'm going to be talking about, but that's not just prophecy. Technically, if you're giving any sort of message from anybody else, you are a prophet for that person. So if somebody is giving you a message from God, that means your preacher is technically a prophet. However, usually when we use the word prophet, we're talking about some messages that were given specifically to one person to give to everybody else. And usually we also think of predictive prophecies. That is prophecy messages from God that have come down to one person in particular that is going to predict something about the future. Now, unlike the other two prophecies we've been over today, you don't have a prophecy class in school. You have a history class and you have a science class, but you have no prophecy class. But that doesn't mean that there is no relevance to prophecy upon our educational experiences. Now, there are worldly ideas of prophecies, and there are people in the world, mostly dead by now, but not all, who have claimed to have predictive prophecies. So I want to show you some of the features of these prophecies. The problem with the prophecies I gave before, they all kind of have the same overarching problem. They are clearly not supernatural. I can't prove I'm from God using those sort of prophecies. You know, looking back on those things, there's probably one among you wearing blue. Well, what do you think the chances were that there would be not one person here wearing blue? I mean, with being alone, chances are it would be stranger if nobody was wearing blue. The second one is so vague, it's being interpreted to mean anything. Oh, great misery. I didn't look at the weather before making that prediction, by the way. If it wasn't raining, where I was just going to turn on the news and wait for a sad story and say that's what the prophecy was talking about. And if I couldn't find one on the news, I would talk to enough people to find something sad. I can find something sad if I really wanted to. The third one is ridiculous because I created it myself. You know, it wouldn't be that impressive even if I didn't create it myself, but, you know, I chose to put the bracelet on my own wrist. And then the final one is predicting something that is inevitable, something that, once again, kind of like that first one, is bound to happen at some point. Can't call any of that supernatural. And yet, There are so many people in the world today who claim certain pieces of advice, you could call it, or words, are predictive prophecy despite falling into these exact same problems. You know, for example, if you remember back in 2012, one of the great supposed prophets for them was talking about the end of the world. That's what a lot of the prophecies are often about. The Mayans supposedly predicted the end of the world in 2012. Well, there are two great problems with that. One, it is 2018. But even before that, there was no actual prophecy. Even if by some fluke the Mayans actually knew that the right word came back on December 21st, 2012, like everyone was saying back then, it wouldn't have mattered. They didn't make a prophecy, just so happened they had a calendar that happened to end on that date. No actual prophecy. That's one of the great prophets. Perhaps more famous, Nostradamus. The prophecy is, if you've heard Nostradamus, he was a French, basically a monk living around 1500 who came up with a lot of prophecies, and they say he was correct about a lot of these things. Well, the problem with Nostradamus' prophecies, and I'll take an example of one of them here in a bit, is that they are too vague. They're using all sorts of language that can be interpreted several ways by saying, oh, what great misery here shall fall from the very sky. Could be interpreted to mean anything. It could be interpreted so broadly and so vaguely that it could anything to count. Another one. Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormons. A lot of reasons people tend to believe in that doctrine is because of the supposed predictions that Smith made. And he made a couple of interesting ones. He made a couple of predictions that, wow, that's really impressive. How'd that turn out to be right? But then there were also some of them that were just completely wrong. I'll take an example of that as well. One more example, though, are the commonly cited psychics of today. These are the one list that you might be able to find today as well. But they fall for a similar, a lot of the same problems. Often the predictions are going to be too vague and can be interpreted in a particular way. Or they'll use this common parlor trick, being able to figure things out about people and say, well, look, I know this about you, so I'm going to know this about the future. And they might say, you might go into a psychic and they see mud on your boots and they figure you must be a working type of person. They say that and they think, you think, wow, this person's amazing. They don't know me, but they know that I work outside for a living. Well, they're just using parlor tricks for that sort of thing. Some of the examples I mentioned before, Nostradamus said this: two steel birds will fall from the sky on the metropolis. The sky will burn at 45 degrees latitude. Fire approaches the great new city. Immediately a huge scattered flame leaps up. Within months, rivers will flow with blood. The undead will roam the earth for a little time. This is one of the most famous prophecies of Nostradamus. People say this is predicting September 11th attack against the United States and New York. Now, there are a few things that look like they might be able to apply to those attacks. You know, two steel birds, well, from the 1500s, you wouldn't know what an airplane is. But, man, that looks like a lot like an airplane. And look, it's talking about a new city. It's talking about a metropolis. But if we look at this a little more critically, DC doesn't really stand up to that scrutiny. Those things are incredibly vague. You can have that apply to a lot of things. Just about anything that may have metal or flying. You know, you said the helicopter the same way. You see the space where this little deck toy, you know, I'm talking about the ones that drink water with the beach there. Maybe that's a steel bird we're talking about. It's too vague there. The metropolis, well, there's a bunch of cities in the world. Why does that include more? In fact, when we look at some of the facts that are put there in addition to that, we see it's just wrong. I don't know about you, but I didn't see any zombies after 9/11. Yeah, he says the undead will walk, will roam the earth for a little while. He also says that it will happen at a city that's 45 degrees latitude, and you look at that. 45 degrees latitude, 40 degrees latitude. If you're going to be as specific as I didn't define, why would he say that unless it is just wrong? Another example of being just wrong, one of the most famous prophecies of Joseph Smith. A revelation of Jesus Christ unto his servant Joseph Smith.
and six elders, as they united their hearts and lifted their voices on high. Yea, the word of the Lord concerning his church, established in the last days with the restoration of his people, as he has spoken by the mouth of his prophets, and for the gathering of his saints to stand upon Mount Zion, which shall be the city of New Jerusalem, which shall be built, beginning at the temple lot, which is appointed by the finger of the Lord in the western boundaries of the state of Missouri, and dedicated by the hand of Joseph Smith and others with whom the Lord was well pleased.
Now, this is Joseph Smith. At this time, back in the 1800s, he said, we are going to have this whole city for ourselves. We will call it Mount Zion. By the way, does anyone happen to know where the current capital, the city for themselves, the Mormons have right now? Do you know what that city is? It's in Utah, Salt Lake City, Utah, not Missouri. He was talking specifically about where the Mormons happened to be at that moment. Now, most of the Mormons were over in a place called Independence, Missouri, and he happened to be in Ohio when he said this. Little did Smith know that at this time, the very day he said this, the Mormons were being expelled from Independence, Missouri, because people couldn't stand them anymore. And he was just wrong. It wasn't going to happen in Missouri. His supposed city was going to be in Utah. I bring up these false prophecies to highlight a quality that the Bible has that no other can possibly claim. The prophecies, predictive prophecies you will find in the Bible, do not have any faults. They aren't so vague that they can apply to just anything. They aren't wrong. Some people might say that a lot of those cases were a little true, and you find out no, not really. You don't find these faults when it comes to the Bible predictions. It doesn't solve some of the problems that everything you find in the Bible as far as predictions can be specific. They will often expire. That's something else you won't see in these prophecies. What I mean by that is when you look at some of the prophecies in the Bible, it will say, this has to happen in such a time. One of those big prophecies we'll be looking at here in a little bit. Happens within a certain window of time. You know, I could say something a little bit more specific. You know, I could say that in this very town, three people are going to be stabbed to death. So that would be a little bit impressive, except I didn't give a window of time. And so, you know what, it's probably not going to happen in Little Sandy Hill, West Virginia, tomorrow or next year. So I'm like, well, I'm going to vote like a moron, but that's probably not going to happen, but what if you get a year? So probably not. What if you get 10 years? What if you get 100 years and by some fluke, then you go, West Virginia ends up being some great metropolis or something along those lines? You never know. You think after enough time, eventually something like that might come true? And you know what the brilliant part about it is? If it never does, people who say I was telling the truth can just say, it hasn't happened yet. The Bible, while not everything in the Bible gives exact dates and times, it gives windows of time often for its prophecies to come true. There are numerous prophecies in the Bible. There are prophecies everywhere. It is said that in the Old Testament alone, there are over 300 prophecies regarding this predictive prophecies regarding Jesus Christ. 300 of them, and every single one of them was fulfilled. It has failed conditions. It says if certain things don't happen, you know, this is a false prophecy. This is a standard and a practice given to us all the way back in Deuteronomy. You know, Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 21 to 22, God says to the Hebrew people whom he is speaking to that if there's someone who says he's a prophet among you, this is how you know if he's actually from me or not. Listen to his predictions, and if nothing comes from it, he is a liar. And how many of you think that counts, by the way? Do you think that, you know, well, listen to his predictions and one of them comes true, then he's telling the truth? Or do you think that even one of them is false? He must be a false prophet. That's even one. And as I've already mentioned, every single one of them ends up being correct. The only predictions in the Bible, which is in certainly that have not come to pass, are those regarding well, maybe this has happened in the past, yes, yeah, that's the end of the world. But there honestly aren't all that many predictions about the end of the world, not as many as people want to make out to do in the Bible. But the predictions that just in the window of time that is spoken of have come, it comes to pass. I want to talk about a few of these major predictions. If you got your Bible, like I don't, this is the kind of paper I am. What I do is,
thank you.
I want you to go ahead and turn to the book of Daniel, chapter 2. This isn't just a year thing, by the way. This hasn't been spoken about the time. Daniel chapter 2 is the first one of these predictions that I want to talk about. Like, as I said, there are hundreds and hundreds of predictions in the Bible which show how these have to be true. But there are a few in particular that really kind of stand out in how impossible it has to come. Now, the book of Daniel was realistically written about somewhere 600, 500 B.C. I'm going to show you the very, very liberal dating of the book of Daniel. The reason I choose that, I remember when Stephen earlier was talking about how archaeologists will say the books of the Bible will often be written after they actually were. Well, I'm bringing up the dates that they are going to say. And the reason I will bring up those dates is to show you that the dates that they are saying, this is the most liberal you're going to find about the Daniel placement in the timeline. But there are things about this that he couldn't have known, even if there was. They are. But if they were, it still cannot be. So, realistically, let's look at Daniel chapter 2. Let me bring out a few of these things here. And verse 31 of Daniel chapter 2, the Bible reads, "You saw, O king, and behold a great image, this mighty and exceeding great that stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet, partly of iron and partly of clay. As you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image of its feet of iron and clay, and broke them into pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold, all together, were broken in pieces, and became like the chaff of the son of threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone struck the image, became a great mountain, and filled the whole earth." So he's talking about a dream the king that was never Babylon had. And this is the dream. He saw a statue that had the head of gold, chest and arms of silver, thighs of bronze, and legs and feet of iron, and then iron and clay. And he saw a great boulder get cut out of the mountain without the hand and smash the entire thing. But he didn't just say what the king saw. He interpreted it for him. Going on in verse 37, "You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given this kingdom, the power and the might and the glory, and into whose hand he has given wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heaven, making you rule over them all, you are the head of gold. Another kingdom inferior to you shall rise after you, and yet a third kingdom of bronze which shall rule over the earth. And there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for the iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things, and by the iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all these. And as you saw the kingdom so partly upon his hand, partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom, but some of the furnace of the iron shall still be in it, such as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay." Let's stop there. Right there, Daniel has made a prediction. He says there are going to be four kingdoms. One, he's already living in, that's the kingdom of Babylon. He says there's going to be three more, however, in that they are going to be worse in some ways, at least as far as Babylon goes. However, you might notice by these medals, and he doesn't bring it out, but I find it interesting, that each one of these medals is progressively a little bit stronger. You know, part of the reason gold is so valuable is because it's very malleable to change and more easily. But as you go down, it gets stronger and stronger. So perhaps greater military might, not as much financial extravagance, though. interesting that after this, there would be four great empires on the earth. One we already mentioned, that's the Babylonians, that's the head of gold. Anybody know what the next great empire to come after the Babylonians was?
The Medo-Persians.
And sure enough, they would be not quite a great financial group, perhaps, but slightly stronger militarily. How about after that? The Greeks, the Macedonians, they came after them as well. And after that came the Romans. Now, the Romans, by the way, started off with a different kind of empire than they ended up with. They started off with a republic. They started off with a very strong, unified republic. However, in the last century of the BC era, you see it started to have a lot of civil wars against itself, eventually culminating in having the Roman Empire as we know it. Sounds a bit like a kingdom that starts off as iron and then kind of loses itself by civil war and becomes a kingdom of iron and clay. Those are also specific prophecies, aren't they? And by the way, he doesn't just stop at the statue and say, well, afterwards we say, well, obviously there's a Babylon, Persia, Macedon, and Rome. No. He said this is going to be a whole kingdom. He already names them. And sure enough, it comes to pass. And even by the most literal days in there, still no way knowing that Rome was coming. How do you explain that except through God's hand in the prophecy? Not only that, by the way, but he goes on to explain that the boulder that's coming through, that's going to be the kingdom of God that is established. You know what he just said there? He created a window of time for one of these predictions to happen. When does the kingdom of God have to be established according to the prophecy? During that fourth kingdom, during the fourth kingdom of iron and the clay. So it has to be during the time of Rome, and it has to be during the time that Rome became divided. Sure enough, Jesus Christ was born, died, founded the church, which is what the kingdom is talking about. All of it during the predicted window of time. Put in another one. Abraham was promised a nation, and there are very specific qualities of that as well. Go ahead to Genesis chapter 12, if you will. Now, when the dating of Genesis goes back to about 700 BC, that would be during the captivity in Babylon. Even kind of mentioned a little bit of that as well. And while, once again, some of these, if it was really written all the way as early as 700 BC, it wasn't, but even if it was, there are some past features of this. The writers just couldn't know. Genesis chapter 12, starting verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abram, go to your country and your kindred and your father's house, the land which I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and to him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in all your families, in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. This is a fairly famous one where God says to Abraham, go to the land where I want to show you, and I'm going to give that to you. Now, we now know he was talking about the land that the Israelites, as his descendants would become known, would receive. They received that land. And there would be multitudes of them. The descendants of Abraham, I would wager a guess, are the most numerous people on earth today. I'm guessing if you're going to have to look back that far and find one person who could take most people on earth today, descended from, and it's Abraham. And it's not just modern day Jews either, by the way. You know, people with Arabic heritage as well are descendants of Abraham, through Israel. And looking to that whole area of the world, in fact, most of them are descendants of Abraham. And just like, by the way, there was a bit of a prophecy or something besides this great nation, you know. Daniel chapter 2, he talks about the great nations that are coming, but there's something coming within. In this prophecy, we also see a prediction of something that is going to be greater as well. And by the way, also that gives us a few little hints about the promised one coming starting in Genesis 3:15, when God says to the serpent who we know is Satan, that I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between her seed and your seed, and you shall bruise the heel, but he shall crush your head. Well, you can figure out he's not talking about just women in general versus snakes in general. It's obviously talking about something greater. It's talking about Christ versus Satan. And once again, it doesn't exactly close with any other reference to Christ, because it says, through Abraham, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. It doesn't make sense if you just say that regarding the Israelites. The Israelites blessed themselves. But it was through Jesus that all nations, that is, Gentiles, that is here truly, would be blessed. So I want to be later on, you don't look at it. I want to put you in mind on that one. Isaiah's suffering servant, little name for the book of Isaiah. Once again, we're talking, this is what the most, the highest biblical praise you can find, someone who doesn't believe the word of the Bible, this is what they will say when they say Isaiah was written. 550 BC, what day was written much earlier than that? That's the birth. 560 years before the birth of Christ, actually, probably more like 570 or 558, but who cares?
Very, very long time.
Look at the entire chapter of Isaiah 53. And you tell me who this is talking about. Let's just talk about a few of these features. Verse 3, he was despised and rejected by a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Okay, this sounds like a pretty miserable guy for whatever reason. Verse 4, surely he is born of grief and carried our sorrows, yet he esteemed his stricken, sin by God, and afflicted. Okay, so he's miserable, and he has his miseries upon him on our behalf. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquity, and upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. He was wounded, he was pierced, he was crushed, he was killed on our behalf. Who does that sound like to you? Who could I possibly be talking about right now? And we, with our 21st century glasses on our familiarity with Jesus, make it pretty clear that's who he's talking about. You would be surprised about how little sense this makes if you're reading this in a long time of history. Verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth like a lamb that led to slaughter, like a sheep that before his fear is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for a generation considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people. Then in his grave with the wicked and with the rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, and there was no deceit in his mouth. It is the Lord of the world, the Lord to crush him. He will put him into grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring, he shall prolong his days, and the will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. So he was killed, apparently, and he was killed on behalf of us, and he was given a grave, rich in his grave. And at this point, now makes intercession for us, on our behalf with the Lord. Once again, to us, this is clearly talking about Jesus. Some of this is eerily specific, talking about not opening his mouth during the trial of his man who gave a lot of sense of himself. That he was going to be pierced. That is a strange method of execution during Isaiah's day, in which method of execution was stoning. You don't pierce somebody when you're stoning to death. Fact says that not one of his stones shall be broken, you know, for the Bible. Here, it even says that we want to make a grave with a rich man. No, he was given a grave with a man of hair, a rich man. The specifics of this, and when you read this from our point of view, it's obvious that you're talking in the past tense about Jesus. It looks like it's in the wrong place in the Bible. It argued in the New Testament. That's where it makes sense. But this is happening even by the most liberal estimation, 560 years before the fact. What does that tell you? How do you get that specific about someone? By the way, these are a few prophecies about Christ that I'm telling you. 300 plus, and each one of them applies. Does this sound like some of the prophecies I was talking about before? Does this sound like the prophecies I was making when I first came in and saying that the occult leader? Does it sound like that? No. Does it sound like the prophecies or some of the false prophecies we looked at? No, well, that's too vague. No. This cannot come from mere man. It has to come from God.
Let's look at some of these other prophecies we see,
and while this is not necessarily a big prophecy, this is something the Bible knows long before we did. It talks about the knowledge of dinosaurs in Job chapter 40 and 41. We see two dinosaurs, and what are clearly dinosaurs to us, described, however, would be unknown to the world until about the 19th century. Another one of the more scientific nature. Ocean currents. Psalm chapter 8 and verse 8 was talked about a path in the ocean, and this was actually used to discover ocean currents. Sometimes it gets really, really specific, and this is one of my favorite ones. Remember, Isaiah was written long before the Medo-Persian Empire, but the main, if you want to think of the main king for that, is Cyrus. He is mentioned by name years before he ever lived. Isaiah chapter 45 and verse 1. The Bible reads, "Thus says the Lord, who is appointed to Cyrus, whose right hand I have grasped, to subdue nations before him, and to loose the belt of kings, to open doors before him, that gates may not be closed. I will go before you and level the exalted places. I will break in the pieces of the door of bronze and cut through the bars of iron. I will give you the treasures of darkness and the hoards and secret places, that you may know that it is I, the Lord, the God of Israel, who call you by your name." Here it says that God is saying to Cyrus, who is not even born yet, "I am going to be with you when you are conquering these great nations." And what happens? That Cyrus has conquered the great nation of Babylon. And he is named as being so before he was born. Not possible for me. The Bible speaks to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. There are a lot of places where we can actually see that. Some of them are a little bit speculative. One of the smallest ones, however, is in Luke 23, verses 28 through 31. And as I've already mentioned, there are over 300 messianic prophecies. That is, prophecies predicting Christ or things about him. So the question is, why is there a class about this? Why don't we know about these prophecies? I expect that if there was a prophecy class in school, it would probably be looking like more of the things you saw at the very beginning. Be more focused on the Nostradamuses of the world. Be more focused on the Joseph Smiths and the psychics and the Mayans of the world, and not so focused on the real prophecies. It is a shame that the public school system has failed us all so miserably that we don't learn everything we ought to about history, that we don't learn everything we ought to about science. And indeed, we don't learn everything we ought to about the Bible and its validity. The prophecies in the Bible is one example of proof of what it says is true. But we don't learn it because of pseudo-intellectualism. Marcus mentioned Romans chapter 1 a little bit earlier. I'm going to go back there because it fits it so perfectly. Romans chapter 1, verse 22. Bible reads, "Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of a mortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things." The reason people don't want to believe these things, the reason people don't want to speak to these things, is because they think they are too smart to believe them. Now, the fact is, no one is too smart to believe anything so long as it has evidence behind it. I have shown you the evidence behind it. I don't say, look, here's what this, what I say, now believe it because I said it, I've shown you the evidence. No, but it has to be the case that these came from God, not man. But there are scholars, there are people in the academic world who believe that they have gone beyond the will of God, which is the same. It breaks too many worldviews to believe in these prophecies. If you come from an atheistic worldview, it's hard to accept that there could be correct prophecies, even as specific prophecies that I have shown coming from dates that these people can remember these things. But they do. So we're going to ignore it because it breaks our worldview. It acknowledges the supernatural also breaking atheism. Psalm 33. Psalm 33, the last verse. I believe, for he spoke, and it came to be, he commanded, and it stood firm. There is an idea, the ridiculousness of the idea that a God could simply speak and have things come out from thin air. Break the world. You would rather believe that it just came out of thin air because of nothing than a God speaking it. Is there a reason to believe one thing over the other? Well, one makes sense. One begins to fit the rationality. One makes sense if you start with the chosen worldview. Starting from an open mind, a truly questioning mind comes to the inevitable conclusion that there must be a God. This is just one of those definitions. I wish I could tell you that things are guaranteed to get better, but they're not. You know, I'm not too much older than most of you. It wasn't too long ago that I was in the public school system myself. And, I know that there are a lot of people out there who really believe some of the stuff they're saying. A lot of the teachers want to believe the stuff they're saying. It's a thing that we are in a situation right now that we have to deal with it. But the good news is you are not relegated to mindlessly believe whatever it is that you have been commanded to learn. You can still learn something without believing it. I believe that Aristotle says the mark of the educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it. You should be able to still learn stuff if you do really well, even if it is a lot. But what I want you to do is to think not simply what you're told. Don't take my word for it because I am saying it. Don't take Martin's word just because he's saying it. Don't take Dave's word just because he says it. Don't take your teacher's word just because he says it. But think for yourself about it. Follow the evidence to see where to conclude. Then yourself. And quite confident. You will see me right away. No, that is my time. I think it's pretty cool.